You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles Hunting Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and I can't believe that 2024 marks 10 years of podcasting. Over the last decade, I have had the pleasure of talking with hundreds upon hundreds of passionate outdoors men and women who share the same excitement for hunting as I do. Whether you hunt public lands or private property, shoot traditional archery equipment or high-powered rifles, we all have one thing in common. And that's our love for the great outdoors. This year, I plan on continuing that tradition and bringing educational and entertaining content to your ears. Thank you for your continued support, and I hope you all have the best seasons of your life. Good vibes in, good vibes out. Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles. And today is a very special day, not only because it's Friday, but because this is a big day in our family. My daughter is attending AAU Girls Wrestling State Championship. Believe it or not, there's about 1,000 girls that are going to be in this place called the Powerhouse Alliant Energy Center, and it's basically a big arena where rock bands or any type of band comes through the area. Comedians have been there, different types of shows. We've been there for a monster truck rally, so it's just a big event. There's 12 wrestling mats laid out on the floor of this arena, and kids from kindergarten all the way to seniors in high school, all girls, are going to be wrestling. As of right now, women's wrestling, girls wrestling, is one of the fastest growing sports in the United States. And it is a sport that used to be just boys. And then, as all sports really, a couple girls started creeping in. And I believe Arizona just had the first ever women's high school state champion in the boys division. So think of that what you will. But anyway, my daughter's going to be wrestling this weekend, Saturday for sure. If she wins twice, then she'll wrestle on Sunday. But we have to make sure we're checking our weight all the time. She has to be 75 pounds on the button. If she's 75.1, then she'll have to wrestle in a higher age class. So this week we've really been managing her diet, making her eat really clean, making sure she's right where she needs to be for a good weigh-in. And right now she's on pace to do that. So that's what is going on in our world this weekend. Another thing that I found out that I hate, I think I always knew that I hated it, but man, shopping for vehicles fucking sucks. A big fat one. And I don't even really know how to explain it, but imagine being stuck somewhere with someone that you don't want to be with, and that's how uncomfortable it is, right? Like, I don't know. My experiences have never gone well, right? And so for the longest time, I've been waiting, shopping for new vehicles. And finally, I had to pull the trigger. My old truck, it still runs really well, but every time I shut my door, rust falls off my truck somewhere. And so that's the shape it's in. I believe it's taken its last trip out west. And so I need something that's a little bit more reliable and that can pull our pontoon boat. Anyway, here's the short story. The short story is I go shopping, right? I go into a couple dealerships. I'm starting to talk with the salesmen and, a couple salesmen, everybody's different, but some salesman is just like real laid back. Here's the price, whatever. Others are real aggressive. Hey, I saw you have, you're interested in this vehicle. What can I do to make it happen? And, I test drove a couple vehicles. I look at them. And there's one company that was like, oh, dude, this is the price. And then by the time I stopped communication with them, they've come off at about, $2,000 or $3,000. They are, they're telling me all these great things about the vehicle, all the information that I already know because I go to Car Gurus and Carfax and I search accidents and how many owners it's had, and so there's those types of guys. And there's the other guys that just, they don't even seem interested in making a sale. They're just like, yeah, this is what it is. And we're not going to move on the price. And so a couple trucks that I tried to negotiate with to hit the price point that I was looking for fell through. And then here's where it's just like, not necessarily deception, but how some of these people talk blows my mind, right? And so I go on Car Gurus and I see a vehicle for sale. I go to the dealership to look at it. Instantly, it's $2,000 higher at the dealership, right? Because Car Guru looks at one price and while maybe that's like a discounted rate if you do certain things, okay? If you don't do those certain things, then you get then you have to pay a different price. Well, of course, I don't want these other add-ons in order to get whatever price it was. I have to do so many things in order to get this price. So I don't want to really call it a bait and switch, but Jesus, man, it, I go in there. I say, what's the price of this truck? They say it's this price. I said, what about all? And then, so he runs the numbers, he hands it to me and he goes, I said, there's like these itemized lines on it. And it was all these different warranties. And I said, what about these warranties? Yeah, those come with a vehicle. Like, so they come with it or are they an option? Well, they just kind of come with a vehicle. And so I stood up to walk out and then the guy comes and goes, well, hey, just one second, if you have time, I'd like to rerun some numbers for you. And so in my head, I'm just like, why don't you run the numbers right the first time and give me the best possible deal on it? That way we're saving each other a lot of time. I didn't say that right away, but anyway, he comes back and shows me a new price. And then I walk out the door, I get back in my truck, I'm driving off the lot. Another guy who's the manager waves me down, takes another $1,000 off the price and is like, hey man, I got to get you, whatever you need. It was a good truck. I ended up buying it. But the point is just sell me the truck. Don't try to bamboozle me into all these extras. Don't try to reword it. Here's the price. These are the add-ons. Here's a warranty add-on. Here's a warranty add-on. And here's your price for the truck. Oh, you don't want that warranty add-on? Okay, scratch it off. And they don't ever really tell you these are optional, right? And so obviously these guys got to make their livings too. But it just makes me feel like I don't know, maybe, and I know there's guys out there who are car salesmen who don't do this, and I'm not saying all car salesmen are bad, but my vehicle buying experience has never been like an extremely positive one. So if you are a car salesman, dude, reach out to me. I want to talk to you about tips and tricks to buying your next hunting truck and how to negotiate price. And I don't know if that would violate, you know, what you guys are all about and like the code of conduct for vehicle salesmen. But I would love to talk with someone who's a good car salesman, who's not into the old style of trying to swindle people out of their money. Again, horrible experience with car shopping in the past. Now, I have a brand new truck sitting in my, not brand new, but new to me, truck sitting in my driveway. And now I gotta somehow try and sell a piece of shit. And I think when I post it to Facebook Marketplace, I'm just going to be like, if you're looking for a truck that will start and will get you from point A to point B, this piece of shit is right for you. So I got to do that yet. Anyway, today's podcast is with one of my oldest friends in the hunting space, in the hunting industry, in the hunting community, Tim Kent. We've known each other for a very long time. We talk on at least a monthly basis, and we get into that conversation. It's a really good conversation about a guy who's right around my age. We talk about family, we talk about sacrifice, we talk about success, and obviously we are outdoorsmen and hunters, so we rope all of that into the conversation as well. We talk about how our goals have kind of changed and what kind of experience we want as hunters. You know, he's kind of into the land leasing. He leases a farm, so he's into the food plots and the habitat management and things like that. I unfortunately don't have the option to do that. But again, really, really good conversation. Now, before we get into today's episode, I need to run through, just a quick run through of all the partners here on the Nine Finger Chronicles. Do me a favor, go visit these guys. If anything, just to take a look at the products that they offer, take a look at them. Maybe they fit your needs, maybe they don't. But I'll tell you, all of these companies that I work with, their products have a place in your daily, weekly, yearly pursuit of wild game fishing in the outdoors. So first off, Huntworth, all right? Everyday clothes, hunting camo, some of the best in the business for the most affordable prices. Go check out huntworthgear.com. Woodman's Pal, if you're looking for a habitat tool, you gotta go check out the Woodman's Pal. It's a machete. This thing is durable, it's made in America, and I use it for cutting shooting lanes, trimming trail camera, like areas to put my trail camera, hacking stuff that's in the way, access routes, all that good stuff. Woodmanspal.com, made in America. Code Blue Sense, dude, you gotta go check out the Rope-A-Dope system, codebluesense.com. I do have a discount code, NFC20. Take a look at all of their products. I'm sure there's something in their lineup that will help you get deer into shooting range this upcoming season. Vortex Optics, I believe later this week or next week, I got a podcast scheduled with Mark Boardman where we're going to talk a little bit about optics and some other hunting gear and equipment that we use on a regular basis. Kind of a suggestion type episode, I believe I'll call it. So vortexoptics.com. Man, they got everything. They have spotting scopes, rifle scopes, binoculars, range finders that are built into binoculars. So they got it all. VortexOptics.com. Wasp Archery. Most of their heads are still made in the United States. They have some of the best material used to build broadheads with some of the best designs for mechanicals and fixed blades. Love these heads. They do a lot of damage. They cause a lot of hemorrhaging, a lot of blood loss. And that's why I use them. And that's why I'm confident in them. WaspArchery.com, discount code NFC20. Tethered. If you're looking for a saddle, saddle hunting accessories, please go to tetherednation.com. Read up on all of the new products that they're offering and their new lineup that's only going to be in retail stores. So keep an eye out for that as well. And that's tetherednation.com. Last but not least, Full Sneak Gear, baby. My company, I just started December or January. I can't even remember how long I've had it. But sales are doing very well. I'm not pushing it too terribly hard right now just from a time crunch. But if you're looking for some kick-ass apparel, t-shirts with deer on it, cool designs, cool crew necks, cool stocking caps and hats. Every single month, I'm going to try to add at least one thing and have a really good lineup for you guys to choose from. So fullsneakgear.com. And that's it. Let's get into today's episode with my good friend, Tim Kent. 3, 2, 1. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I don't really know, like, we've known each other and we've been friends through these types of conversations, you know, over the years. We don't hang out with each other per se a lot, but we do communicate with each other almost more than I communicate with guys who I would consider my closest friends. So that by default makes you a friend of mine, a good friend of mine, Mr. Tim Kent. How you doing, man?
Good. Right back at you, man. And you know, it's kind of funny when you work in this type of space, like an enthusiast industry, I feel like we find a lot of people that, you know, are friends from afar, you know, and yeah. you wish you lived closer together, but then at the same time, you're like, oh man, if we live closer together, would it fall into the same tempo as everybody else that lives close to me? And I'd be like, oh dude, I'm sorry. I haven't seen you in so long. You know, we haven't talked in a while. It's almost, you end up taking it for granted. It's sort of weird.
Yeah, I can attest to that. My best friend, not maid of honor, groomsman, right? The best man. He lives across the street from me, no doubt, two houses away, and we very rarely hang out. I mean, every once in a while, I'll see him outside with his daughter. He'll see me outside with my kids, and then we meet in the street and we talk for a little bit. But that doesn't happen every week. And so even though he is one of my best friends and he lives so close, we still don't hang out with each other as much as we thought we would.
Dude, it's so strange. Like, I don't even talk to my parents as much as I really should. You know, it's just, I was just thinking that this morning. We had my parents over. They helped us grind some venison, not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before. And then they stayed for supper and whatever else. And then I was thinking last night, you know, as I was walking in the door, I'm like, oh geez, I haven't talked to my parents in a week and a half. It's like, that's my parents. It's so hard. You get caught up in the hustle and bustle of life, whatever that is for all of us. And you know, it's just like, oh shit, I should have done this or whatever. I should have called so-and-so. And that's what's nice, like with folks like you and I, is every once in a while you just kind of have the pop in, like, oh man, I haven't talked to Dan in a while. I'm gonna give him a shout, and we catch up and kind of go over what's new and, you know, help each other out and give advice. And I think that's what good friends are all about. You don't need to be around each other all the time or see each other every day. The best ones you can just pick up right where you left off.
Yep, absolutely. You mentioned calling your parents. That's one thing that I do a lot. I don't know. I think a lot of it has to do with this, I don't know, it was an article or it was a post or something like that, probably, that I read, I'd say about 3 years ago. And basically what it says is, hey, if you only see your parents once a year or twice a year, then you're, you know, in the next however many years, you only have like 20 times you'll see them again. So I took that to heart, and I see my parents more than that because they stay real active in my kids' life. But as far as, dude, I call my dad multiple times a week. I call my mom multiple times a week and just touch base with them, just bullshit with them. I got an 88-year-old grandma who, and I've talked about this in other podcasts, like my grandparents were the biggest influences in my life, period. And I make it a point to call her at least weekly to give her an update. And it's crazy how appreciative that she is of those phone calls, right? Which makes me believe, like, dude, that's what I want. I want my grandchildren to be in contact with me and things like that. Because there's a lot of times where life just splits people apart.
Yeah. No doubt. Like you, my grandparents, especially my two grandfathers, I lost both my grandmothers relatively young. The one passed away when I was 10 and the other one, I was 20, mm-hmm. but you know, still it's relatively young. But my grandfathers and I were close. I mean, we would talk at least once a week. My one grandfather lived in Florida part of the year, and I would take my breaks and I'd go down and hang out with him. I'd fly in, you know what I mean? He picked me up at the airport. You know, sometimes I go down with friends. Sometimes I go down myself, and mm-hmm. I go down multiple times a year. The rent was really good price. You know, the food was okay. We lived like bachelors and watched Seinfeld and laughed our asses off, and it was awesome. You know, and that's what we did. We'd go and we'd jump in the car and, you know, we'd ride around, we'd go to the beach and hang out and do whatever, but it was awesome. And you know, when I lost him, I was just devastated. And yeah. You know, I lost him probably, shoot, I don't know, 15 plus, no, I wasn't even married, so probably about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I mean it still weighs on me. And to have somebody that has that much impact on your life is just so critical. And you feel so fortunate. And that's why, you know, when I haven't been in touch with my parents or whatever, I'm like, dang it. And I'm super guilty of letting my day-to-day, you know, responsibilities or communication. And part of it is, by the end of the day, I've been on the phone so much, or I've done so many things. Like, the last thing I want to do is jump on the phone, or there's some other thing that's kept me from doing something else, and I got to jump to that, and just, I got to do a better job at it. I suck. But at the same time, my parents don't call me a lot either. Yeah. So it's, you know, but you got to be the proactive one.
Exactly.
I feel like.
Exactly.
You got to be the proactive one. And so to your point about your grandma, you know, she's probably continuing to live her life a little bit vicariously through you, even if it's not something you share a common bond on. She just, you know, you're doing stuff. And I think that's exciting for the people that we're akin to. It was for them to see us just out there doing stuff and finding success, or, you know, finding our path or whatever it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. When it comes to life, how does Tim Kent balance? Because if you want to be successful, you have to sacrifice. Let's say in business, you have to sacrifice something else. If you want to be an extremely successful deer hunter, you have to sacrifice in other aspects of your life. And I've been going through that, I guess you would call it a struggle, over the years, being self-employed, working every day, it feels like. You know, there's no off days, really. Trying to balance my job, trying to balance being a father, trying to balance being a husband. How do you do that or approach that?
Very poorly.
Yeah.
No, it's a matter of prioritization, right? Yeah. And I've talked about this a lot, whether it's, you know, on podcasts, you and I have talked about it, whether it's people that I coach or whatever. And it's just, you know, it's not a matter of time. It's a matter of priority. And going back to my statement about my parents, like I say, like, oh, it's difficult to find the time. Well, no, you're just an asshole. You've been bad at prioritizing that thing. You know, you time block opportunities for all this other stuff. You really should be time blocking, you know, Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. And that's when you call mom and dad every week. And if you know that that's what you do, then that's what you do. And that's the thing. Like, I know I wake up most days. Winter is a little bit different, but I wake up most days and I know the first thing I'm going to do is brush my teeth. Right. But then the next thing, well, I'm going to take a piss. Right. Yeah. Then I'm going to brush my teeth after I've washed my hands. But and, you know, then I'm going to go to the gym and, or I'm going to go for a run. And that's part two. And then after that, I eat breakfast. And then after that, I start work. And it's sort of the same sequence. And then my work day is blocked out for the things that I need to accomplish. And I might have things that each week they're consistent, whether they're consistent conference calls that I need to do, or they're consistent meetings that I need to have, or they're consistent calls with whomever. But then there's the ad hoc stuff that might come up the day before that I need to find a way to add into each day, you know? And so for me, it's just a reshuffling of the deck and a prioritization thing. And, you know, I know that I always need to make time for my kids. Mm-hmm. You know, my older daughter runs track. And so in the spring, you know, just about a month from now, she'll start having meets. Mm-hmm. And that's Tuesday night. You know, and they might have to change it due to weather or whatever, but I know that Tuesday night at 5 o'clock, I got to be either at our high school or another high school for a track meet. And yeah. I block out that time, and that's her time. That's her sister's and her mom's time. And it's like a little bit of family stuff. And then usually after that, we'll go grab a bite to eat. And for my world, that's the important thing, is like identifying what those priorities are and then making sure that I earmark the appropriate time. And that's how I pack it all in. And then the things that are of lesser priority, they just fall down the list and they get time when you might have it. Like, mm-hmm. I don't mow my lawn anymore, you know, not to sound highfalutin or anything, but we have somebody else mow our lawn because, man, it's just too much each week to go out and do that thing when I could be spending that time doing something else, another yard project on the honeydew list, or spending time with Heather and the kids, or doing whatever. So I just don't do it, you yeah. know. And it costs some money, but to me, that, you know, that trade-off is worth it. Yeah. You know, I've shed the things that aren't as meaningful. I used to, you know, bass fish a ton when I was younger. I loved bass fishing. Then when I moved to New York, the bass fishing isn't as good here. I didn't have the path to discovery. Bass fishing just went away. You yeah. know what I mean? And now I do other stuff. I mean, I'll pick up a rod every once in a while if the kids want to go, or, you know, we're in a place that has a good opportunity, but it's one of those things. I just don't, and I don't put it on my list. Yeah. You know, Saturday's not bass day.
Yeah. I was thinking about success the other day, as far as just a general thought, thinking about what is success. And there's a lot of people in this world that, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? A lot of people, they put these individuals on a pedestal and they say, man, I wish I could be like this guy. I wish I could be like that guy. And I'm just going to now reference in our space some of the people who we look up to. And I'm not saying it's all of them, but who we look up to, and we say, oh, dude, I wish I could go do that. What we don't know, and this is knowledge that I've gained after talking with some of these people, is they're gone 150 days to 200 days out of the year, right? They leave their families behind, or they don't have kids, or they're divorced, or, you know, like there's these things that almost have negative connotations with that success. And I just keep going back to myself and just being like, none of that is worth, for me anyway, none of that, I don't want to sacrifice my family for any type of success at all, ever.
Yeah, I think you're, you know, I'm, and I know you are too, very centered around my family. Like, that's the number one thing that I try and do. I try and be home for dinner mm-hmm. every night. And if I'm not home for dinner, the first thing I do is I walk in the door and I greet my wife. She usually greets me. But, mm-hmm. and then first thing I do is my kids are always in the same spots.
Yeah.
You know, it's just habitual. But I go in and I talk to my one daughter, because she's usually downstairs. Hey, how was your day? You know, and try and pull out what the highlight was, not yeah. some high level thing. Get them to talk about something specific. And I talk to her for a few minutes, and then I go upstairs and I talk to her older daughter in her room. And it's the same thing. I ask her about her day. I ask her something specific, you know, because, I mean, for me, the thing is, like, I want my kids to always look and be like, yeah, my dad cared about what was going on in my yeah. world, you know, and tried to know where I was emotionally at all times, you know, which when you have teenagers, which I do, that's difficult to begin with.
Yep.
And they're going through challenging times. We've all been there. That is the one point in my life I would absolutely not go back to, because it was fun yet brutal at the same time.
Right.
The amount of pressure at that point in your life is absolutely wild.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I want to be involved, you know. Yeah. And we have, you know, like back to the dinner thing, like we have meaningful conversations, you know, every night when, well, maybe not every night, but
yeah,
but we have meaningful conversations as a family for supper. We do a lot of stuff. And what's funny, I was talking to a real estate client of mine a few weeks back, and she's like, you know, but back when I was a kid, you know, she's in her 70s. She's like, you know, that was when your parents were your parents and they weren't your friends.
Yeah.
I really thought about that statement, and I was like, you know, is that an advantage or is that a disadvantage? You know, maybe yeah. there's times where I'm probably soft on my kids because we are a little bit too close and we are a little bit too friendly. And, but at the same time, you know, and my parents did the same thing with me. Like, I know I've developed a unique relationship with my girls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the first 2 years that both of them were alive, I only worked 3 days a week because yeah. I took care of them for 2 days a week. Mm-hmm. I would try and squeeze in work while they were napping or occupied by Teletubbies or whatever.
Right,
but,
right.
You know, I made that time, and as a result, now I feel like I have a unique relationship with them by comparison to a lot of their peers mm-hmm. and their dads. And both of our girls have some really great peer groups and some really great families that they all came from, which is awesome, you know, because they all kind of take care of one another, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But to just know that I have that relationship, because kind of bringing it full circle, I want my kids to want to call me, you know, and, yeah. and find the time to call me when I'm, you know, when I'm a grandpa, or even when I'm not, and just check in. And,
right.
you know, that's, and I want to talk to my parents. I do enjoy doing that. I've just hit a failure mode in my life that, you know, doing yeah. that the last few years, just
yeah.
playing too much whack-a-mole.
Yeah. I'll tell you this, man. I often debate of like what kind of father I should be. And is it the really strict? Is it the fun-loving dad? You know, is it the strict dad? And I think I've done a good job at. It's probably a little bit more strict than it is like fun-loving friend dad. But here's what I'll say: when I give my kids structure, and I say to them, "Hey, listen, I need you to go clean your room," and they'll go, "I don't want to clean my room," or go, you know, go do this, and I make them do it. After they don't like it, they go and do it. But afterwards, I can still get them to come over and give me a hug, sit on my lap, hang out with them and things like that. And they keep coming back to me for that. And so that tells me right there that I'm doing something right, because God forbid, and I don't know how to say this properly, but I don't want to turn my kids into pussies, right? I have to teach them how to handle pressure in their life. And if I have to ride them a little bit, then in order to get to that conclusion, then I think that's what you need to do.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I think that's one of the most important things, and that'll be the great separator as we move forward, as our world continues to change, especially as more technology comes into play and
yeah.
people don't know how to communicate and have interpersonal relationships as well.
Mm-hmm.
to have those interpersonal skills and have that drive, and the coupling of those two things will be critical. My kids are not the world's best students. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. But the one thing that their teachers always comment on is they're like, your kids know how to work, mm-hmm. and your kids know how to communicate. And it's like, I never worry about them being, you know, back to your term, like successful in life, because they possess those two skills. Yeah. You know, if you have that, you're that much further ahead. You know, to your point about success, I think there's a lot of times where people will also say like, oh, if I had, or if I this, or if I did that. And it's like, you are only seeing this little keyhole view mm-hmm. of what those people did or are doing. You, to your point about sacrifice, you don't know what kind of sacrifice they had to make. You don't know what kind of discipline they had to have. You don't, you know, you're seeing, you know, like, let's talk about television shows. Like, all you're seeing are the good days. Like, you know what I mean? You're seeing all the very best days. You're not seeing all the days that are absolutely terrible. And, you know, the days where they don't want to get up or they don't want to do something. And it's the same thing with anything, you know, like, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a fitness influencer or a hunting influencer or a hunting TV show person or somebody who's a newscaster or whatever. And they think like, oh, how'd they get that break? Well, generally speaking, they probably worked their ass off. Mm-hmm. Unless they're Anderson Cooper and they're related to, you know, wealthy family.
There you go.
You know, but still, that guy, I'm sure, had to make sacrifice in order to achieve his position and where he is.
Yeah.
Still had to work toward things.
You just have to make sure that the sacrifice is the thing that you're sacrificing is weighed right. I don't know how to say that. So for me, if I'm sacrificing time away from my family, I have to balance that really well. Cause I don't want to sacrifice my family too much. Cause ultimately if I leave on a hunting trip, my family is sacrificing because they don't have me there to help with, running the household. So,
yeah, you don't want to damage your cornerstones.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, that's the thing, like the things that matter most, you don't want to damage those. You can damage your cobblestones because mm-hmm. they're replaceable. They're small. They're not as significant, but man, you damage those cornerstones. You mess up your relationship with your wife or your kids or somehow your work or whatever, like you're in trouble.
Right.
You know, it's going to be difficult to recover from that. And now that's negatively impacted your foundational structure, who you are, and your abilities to move forward, you know, again, on a strong foundation. So you got to prioritize all that.
Yeah. So on a couple episodes ago, I was talking with Tony Peterson, a mutual friend of ours. And
that guy.
And we had a, you know, we had a conversation about like midlife crisis. Okay.
Oh yeah.
And that's kind of where I want to pivot to on this one is, what year, if you can pinpoint a year or maybe however many years ago, did you hunt the most days out of the year? Do you remember that year? And how many days was it out of the year?
I was probably in my early to mid 30s. Mm-hmm. So I would say somewhere in the 32, 33, 34
time
frame. My kids were younger, but still at that age where they were kind of, well, let's see. So our youngest daughter would have been pretty young at that point, but getting to the point of being manageable. Mm-hmm. And then our older one would have been to the point where there was independence developing, if that makes sense. So it made it easier for Heather. She's always been really supportive of time afield. But it probably would have been around that time. I mean, I used to do 3, 4, 5. I think the most I ever did was like 7 out of state hunts in 1 year.
Holy smokes.
And I wish I had that money back, but but it was a lot. And in retrospect, I look at it now and I go, oh, wow, that was probably too much. To your earlier point, that's probably why some of these people end up divorced, single, you know, whatever, hated by their spouse, their kids. And, you know, I just didn't want to do that. I do think one of those years I was like super, super happy. But I think that's kind of when you're in a, a point in your life where you're really starting to blossom overall.
Yeah.
You know, with all things, mm-hmm. and you just are like, oh yeah, this is pretty good. I'm in a pretty sweet run right now. But overall, like, I don't like hunting. Not that I don't like hunting that much, but I don't like going that much, because now I see the downside risk of some of that, whether, again, it's on the road or even at home. Like, I used to hunt darn near every day at home. Now I just cherry pick whenever the weather is going to be best, or I have, you know, intel from a camera that says I should do something or whatever. But other than that, you know, I'm more selective now than I've ever been. And I seem to enjoy my days afield quite a bit more, and don't have the same level of frustration that might ensue when you have 3, 4, 5 days in a row that things don't go how you wanted them to. You know, so
why do you think guys around our age who have been in not the hunting industry, but who have been in it, meaning hunting, you know, for damn near 20 years now or more, we start to slide away from quantity and try to pull quality hunts?
I don't know if you've ever heard that 5 stages of the hunter term. Mm-mm. Right? So there's like the I might get these exact terms wrong, but there's like the initiation phase. There's the limiting out phase, the trophy phase, the process phase, and the sportsman's phase. But I think, you know, you can be in multiple phases at the same time. But I think when you're kind of pushing towards something every day, there's probably like an element of, I needed to get that field experience and that field knowledge and everything else. And then apply that every time I was going, and then maybe experience the success from it. And success doesn't mean necessarily that you ran an arrow or a bullet through a big deer's chest, right? It might mean that you still outsmarted them, but you missed them, or they were just outside of your effective range, you know, your effective bow range. You know, maybe your range is 40 and big buck walk 50. You know, it's just like, ah, man, so close yet so far away.
Yeah.
But you get to this, point where you start carrying those pieces of experience forward with you, and you look at it and you want to apply it in a different way, or you're more involved in the process side of things. Yeah. I mean, at this point in my life and in my hunting career, I get a lot more excitement and a lot more gratification, I think, almost out of like going and working dirt and putting in food plots, mm-hmm. and, you know, doing that type of stuff, or doing a habitat improvement, or, I mean, stupid stuff, man, like watching a deer interact with a licking branch that I created, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, a rope or anything like that. I really dig that. Or switching things up and going from hunting out of a tree stand that's in this location to hunting out of a ground blind that's in that location, because it was just a little bit smarter. But for the longest time, I thought, well, eventually that deer is going to walk past me if I stay here. Oh, no. You know, being a little bit more mobile. I don't know. I just feel like the process stuff has just become super fun, man. Yeah. I feel like I do my hunting in like the summer and the early fall now, you know, when I'm planting. I talk back to earmarking time. Like, I will earmark time for working on habitat work and food plot. I mean, you know, and I'll come home, I mean, just an absolute mess, and I'll walk in the door and Heather will just like laugh at me. She's like, oh, a little dusty today.
Yeah.
You know, because I'll be out tilling or doing whatever. But I love that part. I mean, there's the first food plot I ever planted was a long, long time ago. It was on a piece of ground that I got permission for from this doctor who owned it. And my friend and I, you know, told him we'd plant the food plots. He just had to let us borrow his tractor in order to do it. And he said, yeah, sure. And opening day of bow season that year, we went out, the three of us, the doctor, my friend and I, and I was sitting on one of those food plots, and we planted two little teeny, like 1/8 acre ones, and then one that was probably 1/2 acre total.
Yeah.
And I watched a deer walk into one of those food plots that we planted. And I was like, I did that. You know what I mean? I created that place for them to come and for that food for them to eat on. And it was just like such an overwhelming feeling knowing that, you know, it was so cool. Now I probably take it for granted, but I just really, it was a doe and two fawns, but watching them just waltz in and start eating on something that I put in the dirt. I had no farming experience. I had no food plot experience. I didn't know what I was doing. I just read a bunch of stuff, went to some seminars, had some friends that were doing it, and I learned from them. And it was awesome. And, and to sort of anymore to see the way that you can sort of build a mousetrap and have it come together, that's way more enjoyable and way more satisfying than going out and trying to make it happen every single day in October, November, December, you know, whatever. So
do you ever get the urge to go back to the old ways and stomp on public or knock on doors on a different state and like go straight banshee again?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. You know, I'll hunt on public every once in a while. And I'll go and I'll check out public ground and look for spots to do stuff, you know, topography or, you know, scenes or that type of thing. And I'll get excited about it, but you know, I don't do it as much, but you know, same thing. Like I kind of just don't deviate as much from what I have and is sort of a little bit of a known commodity. Although if I do get a new piece of ground, I get pretty excited about it. Or, you know, I also have the benefit of I sell land, right? So I get to go and walk ground every day. And when I do, well, not every day, but most days. And when I look at that ground, I'm looking at ways to change it or what the deer are doing now. Yeah. You know, I was on a piece of ground a couple of days ago and I was like, wow, this place is probably awesome. If I was hunting this, I'd have a stand here or I'd be doing this or, you know, I'd cut this or do that and approach from here. And so I get to kind of like mentally break stuff down all the time. And that's super fun. Yeah. And it's kind of like back to the process thing, like solving that riddle and watching things unfold is just, I have a much higher level of appreciation for that component of the whole process than just loosing an arrow or firing a bullet and that's it. That used to be like the pinnacle and now it's not. The pinnacle has slid back to the earlier stages of everything.
Yeah. Yeah. So you work for Whitetail Properties, correct?
Yep.
Okay. Whitetail Properties, you sell land, whether it's farm ground or recreational. And I want to talk about recreational land for just a second, you know, and we'll just focus on deer hunting or whatever, you know, they want to hunt on this land. That's one of the reasons they're buying it. What are your clients looking for when they come to you and say, Tim, I want to buy a farm so I can hunt on it? What are they looking for? And what, like, is it a reality or do you have to set expectations?
It depends upon the level of experience and education that the person has. You know, I would say in all the people that we've worked with, I've probably had a handful that were truly serious, you know, hardcore big buck hunters.
Yeah.
And those guys know, first of all, they know specifically what they're looking for, generally speaking. They know specifically what they're hoping to achieve. And in my group, they generally have had the means to accomplish whatever the next step is. They're not afraid of looking at a piece of raw ground. They will look at a piece of turnkey ground where somebody else has already done the work. But, you know, they always have different expectations. The challenge that we face here in New York, you know, we've got some good deer, like, but the whole nation now has good deer. I don't care where you are. You could be in Connecticut, you got good deer. You can be here in New York, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Iowa, Nebraska, Indiana, you know, we're at Ohio, everywhere's got good deer. You know, I think even in the South where people have said, oh, there's no good deer in South Carolina. Well, you know, some of the stuff that's coming out now, yeah, there are some good deer in those places. So it's identifying the places where they exist and then maximizing that. So in my real estate territory, I've got pockets that, like, okay, yeah, you're looking for good deer hunting. We're gonna look in these specific towns, you know, because those specific towns, you can't look at it like a county. It's not like, you know, whatever counties in Illinois or Iowa or wherever that are very specific. I mean, everywhere you go in Iowa is almost as good, but you know, but like you get into these certain towns and there's just these little hubs and you might have 2,000 acres, right? And they're just producing bomber deer left and right in that block, you know, in that little portion of town. And so when we have guys that are serious, we'll direct them to those areas and what's available, and then try and find stuff again, whether it's turnkey or something that they can turn into what they want it to be. So,
Gotcha, gotcha. As a landowner now, has your feeling for the natural resource, have you got, do you feel like you are in some way, shape, or form kind of responsible for the natural resource being a landowner?
well, I don't own land. I have the same, I've leased the same land,
Oh, okay.
the same people for 20 years. And so I have a lot of latitude with them. Like I have a really strong relationship with those folks personally. And so as they've aged, they've done less farming. They've done, and as a result, I've been able to take over and do stuff. Like they did a logging project like 8 years ago, and before they signed the contract, they called me and they're like, "This is just wild." You know, they called me up. They're like, "Hey, are you okay if we log this year?" It's like, it's your land. You own it. You know what I mean? Like, but I'm so appreciative of that level of, you know, respect for my opinion. But it's like, I'm not paying. Well, I'm probably paying most of the taxes, but like, I didn't pay for this. Like your dad bought this ground. You boys have it now. I'm a guest. You know what I mean? I'm a hotel guest. I'm a rat. You know, I'm just trying to shoot some deer, but we have such a good relationship and I'm so grateful for that. And I'm sure like all things, eventually, you know, money will get in the way of that because they're going to want to retire. And there's been some talk of them wanting to sell their place and maybe me helping. And that's a tough conversation. It's like, oh, well, you know, undo your own, you know, your own place, but it happens, you know. But as far as the stewardship is concerned, that's one of the reasons why we've been able to maintain this long-term relationship is they've known since the beginning that, like, you know, I cared about that land and I cared about that relationship, and they were both very important to, you know, to me. So we've done this for, and they've had people offer way more money than what I pay, you know. And the one brother who kind of is the primary point of contact, well, one of the brothers passed away this year, but is owned by three brothers, and they're always like, "We know what we've got in you and your group, and you know, we know you guys, and we know how much you care for the place, and we know how much you know you monitor it and do all the things that you do, and we don't see any benefit in trying to take a risk and bringing someone else here for what? Okay, they're going to pay us more money for 1 year, and they don't know how to leverage the resource, and then they're dissatisfied, and then what? Then we have another group in here. Like, no, we know every year you're coming back. We know exactly who you are and what we're getting, and there's comfort in that. And I have a high level of appreciation for that because that's not common anymore. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, I can get $2,000 more than what those guys are paying me. Let's do it. You know, it's just like, so,
Recently, I had a guy on from Texas, okay, and he was talking about how like the only thing he's ever known is pay to play, either through hunt clubs or leasing or like obviously there's a lot of outfitting down there as well. Where do you think the direction of the Midwest, and I'm going to include New York, Pennsylvania in the Northeast into this conversation as well. Do you see the future of hunting going towards that direction of Texas?
I think we're already there. I you know, I mean, that's the biggest thing that I hear from people is lack of access. You know, and I'm guilty of this, right? You know, you might have 400 acres that, used to have 10 people that hunted it, and now 3 people hunt it. Mm. You know, and you see it all over the place. But I also, until a few years ago, I also heard people just totally bash hunting on public ground. Mm-hmm. And I look at that and I go, dude, I mean, just access to acreage. Where I grew up in New Jersey, in the northwest corner of New Jersey, and people are going to think, oh, New Jersey, like, what do they have for hunting there? Well, in the northwest corner, I had, like, within 40 minutes of my house, I had, like, 50,000 acres of different pieces of public that I could go and hunt.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. You know what I mean? Like, I had a stand for every single wind direction, you know, no matter what. I wasn't pigeonholed to, oh no, I got to my spot and there's a truck parked there. Mm-hmm. Okay. I just moved to the next one, 'cause I had 3 more on that piece of public for that particular wind direction. Like, there's a lot of flexibility in that. And, you know, I can't say that I killed a bunch of big bucks on public in New Jersey, but I have killed a few here in New York, you know, on public ground. And same thing, I hunted this piece of public that was like 7,000 acres, not far from where we live. And man, I've walked darn near every inch of that place. And I just loved that, you know, and it was mostly big woods, but edged by ag and that type of stuff in some spots. And you go and you take advantage of that. But it was always an adventure, and that was fun. So kind of back to my point is, you still have access to ground. Mm-hmm. And it's just people want to turn their nose up to it because they don't think about the opportunities, or they think, well, that, like, there's a truck in my spot. Well, it's not your spot. It's public land. You know what I mean? So just do the work to go find another spot that you still have a high level of confidence in. You know, the only time where that became a little trickier was during gun season. Mm-hmm. When the pressure is on, you got more guys walking around and just not as experienced or not as educated, or doing deer drives and really getting the deer spooked up and that type of stuff. That would get sort of tough.
Yeah.
Both in New Jersey and here at home. But otherwise, like, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity. And but yeah, to your question, we're already there. I mean, I see it in the place I hunt in Illinois. I see it here at home. I mean, I have, again, through my real estate business, like, I work with a few people that own lots and lots of land, and they lease most of their ground up. And I am blown away by how much they're leasing that stuff per acre in New York. You know, it's high dollar stuff, and people are clamoring to get access to ground, just absolutely clamoring for it. I mean, you could lease darn near anything here, you know.
And I can understand that in a state that has a lot of public ground, or maybe not even a lot, but more, you know, I'm talking about Iowa now. I think the county that I grew up in had, I want to say, in an entire county, maybe 200 acres of public ground. And there's certain states or certain counties in Iowa that don't have any public land.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or if they do, it's like a field. It's a strip of field that's planted in prairie grass. You know, it's nothing, maybe for pheasant hunting, no deer hunting. And so I look at the future of hunting in a state like Iowa, where eventually it's going to turn into private landowners being the gatekeepers of hunting access in some way, shape, or form. In the direction that everybody goes, as far as pay to play, some people can afford it, others cannot. And so it's just something I'm always thinking about, all these different layers that kind of come into play when talking about the future of hunting. And so I'm always interested in talking with anybody from guys who hunt public to landowners, to guys who lease, you know, to guys, to get all their thoughts on the direction of hunting. And maybe this is a little bit of the pessimist in me, but I just feel like it's the glory days of hunting are over, and it's now come to a like storage rental type of deal, right? And that's the first thing that came into my mind. But it's like, hey, I got this place, it's for sale or it's for lease, you know, if you want to hunt, you got to pay for it, right? Because I can't,
yeah.
I can't in Iowa, I can't knock on doors anymore. It's rare.
Yeah, permission is really, really rare. I was listening to a podcast a few years ago, and there was a guy on there, a pretty well-known dude. I'm not going to mention his name, but he was saying, like, he sends out these letters to landowners, and he's got to send out at least 20 for permission, mm-hmm. right? But 20 letters to get one permission opportunity where he was hunting. And again, that was in Iowa, in an area that's not as desirable as some of the other places in that state. But yeah. I think access is definitely one of our biggest challenges and threats for the future and for retention. Mm-hmm. You know, it's definitely going to continue to be a thing. It's tough because you could say that the boomer generation is sort of going to start retiring out of hunting, starting to see that guys in their 70s or 80s or, you know, portions in their 60s. But then I think you start to lose some of the financial component of them being license holders and all of their contributions, mm-hmm. As well as just the overall industry. Yeah. And then also there's the strength in numbers component of that, you know, so like if we start losing at X percent per year, that's going to start to be, and I think we're already starting to see that a little bit with people aging out. That's going to be both an opportunity and a threat. It'll be an opportunity because you'll have to put less people into the space mm-hmm. available, but it's a threat because now we have a smaller voice. Yeah. Hopefully we can still speak with a louder tone, yeah. But we'll see.
Yeah.
You know,
so. I don't know, man. I just can't help. I keep thinking about my kids. I'm like, where are they?
Yeah.
Where are they going to hunt when I am no longer hunting? And so I got to do my job on how to teach them how to kill deer. Right. And not just be like, hey, you can sit right here in this box and you can shoot them when they come out. Cause I've never hunted that way. I doubt they're ever going to hunt that way. And so I got to figure out, like, it is actually on a piece of paper in one of my notebooks where it's like things to do in 2024. And it's just educate my kids on how to become outdoorsmen.
The thing is too, there's a lot of really good hunters out there.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not special when it comes to hunting, you know, like I'm sure if anybody were to walk on, you know, any place that I hunt, they'd be like, oh yeah, that idiot put a stand in a very obvious spot. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And so there's a lot of people that can find success, and it doesn't matter whether it's elk or antelope or mule deer or whitetails or turkeys or whatever, like people are able to identify where those animals are. And as a result, it's going to attract more individuals to those areas, whether it's public or private. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, concentration of people. And that's sort of what we're seeing with the Western hunting side of things. It's like, you know, especially elk, it's just gotten harder and harder and harder. And to your point, like, Tony and I were actually talking about this via text the other day, like the glory days of elk hunting, gone.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they're over, man. And I think he and I missed it by 20 years. I mean, it's harder to get a tag. It's harder to find access. And when you do find animals on public, other hunters that are of the same quality or better than you have already identified where there are. So it's like a night at the Roxbury. Like we're all humping each other to sort of get in there, whatever, you know? So
yeah.
What's up? You know, so.
Me, you going after that? Me, you, me,
yeah,
you,
yeah,
me,
yeah.
You. oh man. Do you have a memory over the course of your hunting career that stands out? Maybe it's a specific year or a season, or maybe even a specific hunt per se that sticks out that you think about often.
Hmm. don't have like any one particular thing that's like the pinnacle day or pinnacle thing. I mean, it's not really, man. Yeah. I could think of like a lot of very distinct days that are indelibly in my memory for different reasons. I think a lot of people intuitively would think like, oh, well, on that day I found success, or maybe you found failure. Like mm-hmm. maybe the arrow didn't hit its mark, you know? But I can think of, you know, days where just saw a lot of movement, or the weather did some really cool stuff. I mean, but it's not like one particular thing that's, I think, at the apex and it's like, oh, that was the day.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think of this one morning. I always thought this was cool. I don't know if you've ever heard of ice fog, where like fog actually freezes. Like you hear about it like in Alaska and that type of stuff. Well, you know, there was this one morning that I went out and I was bow hunting, and it started out, you know, it was foggy. It was really, really still. And the wind picked up, and the wind picked up just ever so slightly, but the temperature dropped. And when it did that, it just, everything crystallized. And it was like moving. The fog was like moving in the air because of just that little bit of air movement, whether it was the thermals or whatever.
Yeah.
It was and like, I remember at that time I used to have a little thread off my stabilizer, and I kind of like would wad up the end so that way I could see what the wind was doing. And I remember that all just like crystallized over the time that I was in the stand. It's just one day that like a unique, you know. And I saw a few deer that morning. It was relatively slower, like most still days are in my experience, but it was just really, really cool. And then I can remember a couple other days, you know, again, where it wasn't just about the deer. It was like, you know, sitting in this one spot, and again, wind picks up, and it's just raining these golden yellow leaves.
Oh, yeah.
They're just coming down and coming down and coming down, and just sitting there thinking like, this is why it's worth it to be out here.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, catching sunsets and sunrises and all that type of stuff. I mean, you know, I had one day that this past fall caught just a killer sunrise, one of the best ever, and then had one of the best mornings of deer hunting that I've ever had without a buck tag in my pocket. You know, it's just watching a parade of bucks and does and everything else. And, you know, I ended up shooting a doe that morning, but like, it was awesome. It was just super cool. But I have lots of those that I try and remember. And that's why I go out there. You know, it's why I do those things. So,
yeah.
You know, and then there's some things where, you know, you shared a hunt with somebody, you sat together or you did something else. And like, I have some funny ass stories of, you know, two assholes sitting in rainbow chairs on the ground. That's all we had, beach chairs, no less. That's all we had access to in the place that we were hunting, you know, and we found some deer that were doing some stuff, and it's like, all right, well, we got to work with what we got. Yeah. You know, just building this makeshift ground blind, me and my buddy, and just, you know,
yeah,
doing dumb stuff and having fun. And that's what it's all about. It's not all serious all the time anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I was talking on previous episodes, you know, I have openly talked about drinking and alcohol and things like that. And I, you know, I said, hey man, I think it cost me quite a bit of time, but in that time frame, I'm sitting in a tree stand when I used to film my hunts for White Knuckle. My buddy Ryan, he was in the tree with me a lot, and he goes, hey man, those drunken stories, they got us through a lot of long sits. So he appreciated the stories that came out of my alcoholism.
Is that Iberg?
Yeah. Iberg. Yeah. Ryan. Yep.
That guy's awesome.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, I mean, we would, and I guess that's where, you know, the word we're talking about now is just like perspective, right? And just how, I don't know, every moment is so, of life is so important, man.
I do have a good sharing a blind story with a dude. So I was out in Montana antelope hunting with my buddy Keith. God, I hope he hears this. I'll have to send him the link because he'll laugh. So we're out there, and the first day that we're there, it was just, I think it was like Labor Day weekend. And the first day that we're there, we're sitting this little stock tank right on the border of some public and some private. Like, we're like maybe 30 yards away from the edge, you know. And so we could see these antelope, and they were bedded up on the hill out in front of us. We got in there before dark and whatever else, or before daylight rather. And we're sitting there, and all of a sudden I see a warden's truck. You can see the road.
Yeah.
You know, that's like most of the stuff. I see the warden's truck drive up the road. You hear it, you know, right, along the gravel. And then that thing turns back around or comes back the other direction. I was like, I wonder if that guy's going to come out and give us a hassle, you know. And
yeah,
when one of these antelope that was up bedded up on the hill was really, really nice, you know, just a beauty, heart shaped horns and yep, whatever else. Well, next thing we know, you know, it's been a little while and we don't think anything of it. We didn't hear that truck anymore. Well, a few minutes later, we hear somebody walking up behind us. And where we were, it was actually a plowed field. Mm-hmm. And behind us was an alfalfa field and the water tank. That's why we were hunting there. Anyway, so we hear somebody walking up behind us, and I can't get the blind door open or whatever. And next thing I know, I hear knock, knock, game warden. Like, the antelope take off, you know, as expected, right? They may have taken off beforehand and we didn't know why, but
yeah,
guy does a full overview of my license, whether or not I was shooting, because you couldn't shoot mechanicals at that, or maybe you could shoot mechanicals, not lighted nocks. That what it was. Checks my nocks, make sure I'm not shooting lighted nocks. Asks me my poundage of my bow, my let off. I mean, he's just running me through the ringer on all the questions. And, you know, he's here, and my buddy, we had a video camera. He's like, well, what are you guys filming for? And we're like, just for ourselves. Like, oh, it's not for, is it for commercial use? And I'm like, no, we're not filming for anything. It's just for me. And he, you know, ran us through, because obviously we would have had to have had a filming permit mm-hmm. if we were doing anything with the footage. So as a result of our game warden experience, we end up deciding that we're going to move spots up to another water hole that's further up the road. So we go and we set up on this water hole, and that was actually on some block management ground. So we had to get permission from this guy, who I won't say his name, but between my friend and I, he will forever be famous. So we set up on this water hole up there. First day we come in, we watched, you know, we watch all these antelope and whatever. Well, we ended up running into that guy like midday or at the end of the day, and he talks to us. Dude, the guy is hammered up, man. I mean, he is just shit-faced drunk. Like, every time we run into him, he is shit-faced drunk. Like, guy's my hero, you know, at that point in my life. So we go to this water hole again the third day. We had left our blind, and we go in, and we're sitting there, and then, like, you know, like late morning, all of a sudden, like, this 80s rock music, and I don't remember what it was. I wish I could have made the story funnier. Comes on, he's just blasting it, you know what I mean? Like, whatever, Journey or some shit, just blasting out. Well, that goes on for a little while, and, you know, one would think you'd be discouraged, but this guy and I are in good spirits, and those antelopes seem completely unaffected, you know. And, and this guy was one of the ones that told us to come up and hunt that water hole, that he saw antelope all the time. Well, a little while after that, we're sitting there, you know, again, it's getting to the heat of the day, temperatures rise, and all of a sudden we hear, like, porn.
Pornography?
Like, yes. Like, the moaning of porn. Like, at the same level as the music happening from this guy's house, right? Because, like I said, we're not far from his house. We're a couple hundred yards. Dude is clearly watching porn. Blasting it at, you know, cranking it up to 11 for however many minutes until he's done, apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
And the porn gets turned off, and my buddy and I are just dying, and you know what I mean? Like,
what's that noise? You listen closely.
Is he fucking with us? You know what I mean? Like, so this story is literally, this dude is infamous for us. And, you know, this story is legendary. And we ended up killing an antelope that night, you know, later that afternoon. But yeah, that was my only experience. So that one probably is like the apex funny story, you know, where everything came together and we even got entertained, unexpectedly.
Yeah.
By
that's
yeah,
funny.
By
well,
the, by the crazy drunk guy whose block management land we were on.
What state was that? You said
Montana.
Okay, Montana, where you know he's probably you. I mean, in Montana, you probably can play pornography as loud as you want with your windows open, surround sound, because no one's really going to hear it except maybe a couple hunters.
For sure. I mean, his place was like the only place on that road for quite a distance because they owned multiple sections on that on that road, you know what I mean? And it was intermittent between BLM land and then this block management ground.
Yeah.
So
how, what year was that?
It was the year our younger daughter was born, so that would have been 2011.
Okay, 2011. So do you think do you think the pornography was DVD or VHS? Did he seem old school?
Dude, this was definitely VHS.
Yeah, that's what I
thought. If I had to judge by the man. I mean, he we'll put it this way. The dude like was living on 30 racks of natural ice. So yeah, there's no question it was VHS.
I am envisioning this dude in my head right now, and I bet you if I could turn my thought into an actual picture, it'd be a pretty close representation of this guy.
He'd probably nail it.
Yeah.
He'd probably nail it.
Oh man, yeah. I've been in a tree stand before, nothing like that, but I've been close enough to a couple houses where I heard a wife and a husband get into a pretty heated argument where shit was being thrown in the house, and I'm like, yeah, do I need to call the sheriff right now? But I don't think there was any domestic violence going on. I just think that they were in a really heated argument.
They were emphasizing their points.
Exactly.
We later, you know, went to town and took that antelope to the processor and ended up talking to a few people, and you know, turns out around town, the guy's nickname was Drunk Dean.
old Drunk Dean.
I see you met old Drunk Dean. Yeah, we sure did.
Sure did.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Behind his water hole. It was awesome. Gotta go. Yeah.
Mr. Tim Kent, man, I really do appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on and BS with me for a little bit. Great conversation as always between us and sending good vibes to you and your family, and I hope this upcoming season, man, pays off for you.
Thanks, you too, dude.